They say you gotta spend money to make money. If you're Target, you gotta spend money to beat Walmart and Amazon. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, November 21st. Happy Thanksgiving Eve, and thanks for spending some of it with us. I have a helpful message for those of you who think the worst thing you can do is bring a salad to Thanksgiving dinner. Do not eat romaine lettuce, any of it, from anywhere or in anything. That's the message coming from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention this week. Dozens of people in 11 states have been sickened by E. coli bacteria that was traced back to romaine greens. But investigators still haven't figured out how the lettuce got contaminated. For more on that, here's Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino.
At a Whole Foods store in downtown Los Angeles, there's enough food to fulfill your every Thanksgiving desire. Unless it's salad. Shopper Eric Shin came to stock up for his holiday feast and found some empty shelves and this notice.
Following a nationwide advisory from the CDC, Whole Foods Market has removed all romaine lettuce and products containing romaine lettuce.
Retailers and restaurants across the country have been throwing out any and all romaine products until a source of the contamination can be identified. And that's tough with produce, says Sarah Sorcher with the Center for Science in the Public Interest.
The trail goes cold, and they're able to trace it just one link up the supply chain.
She says current regulations only require vendors to keep records from one step before and one step after they get their hands on it. And there are a lot of hands on romaine lettuce, according to food science professor Haley Oliver at Purdue University.
From planting, you know, to harvest, processing in a processing plant where it's triple washed, to cutting it up into those more convenient pieces.
That's a lot of opportunities for bad stuff to get into our food. Oliver says new blockchain technology could make it possible to track data from all these steps, but it's going to take a massive investment.
Because that individual producer is going to have to know, okay, where did the seeds come from? And from there, be able to forward the information to the next person in the supply chain.
Until that happens, Whole Foods shopper Eric Shin, like many other consumers this week, is playing it safe with his holiday side. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Now that dinner is out of the way, let's talk about shopping. Target disappointed investors with its quarterly report earlier this week. Not like investors were in a good mood anyway. But Target said the reason for its miss is that its investments in online shopping are weighing on its profit margins. But those same investments are starting to pay off in other ways. Online sales jumped 49% in the latest quarter. Look out, Amazon. Marketplace's Erica Barris has more on that.
For years, Target focused on its physical stores. But these days, a lot of investment is going into its online presence, where in-store and curbside pickup have helped the company. Wharton Business School professor Barbara Kahn says in lots of parts of the country,
people are in their cars anyway. In fact, it's more convenient for some people than having to have it delivered at home at a particular time and waiting for the delivery, et cetera.
For Target, all that investment in keeping prices low while slashing shipping costs isn't cheap. Not for Amazon either. But the company can afford that, says Mark Cohen, business professor at Columbia University. Amazon has an independent web services profit generator. Its competitors, like Target,
they don't have an offset to cover off all of that that entails. And so they're running at a tremendous disadvantage in that regard.
A big advantage Target has is its 1850 brick-and-mortar store, says Ari Lightman, who teaches digital media and marketing at Carnegie Mellon University. He says Amazon, with the purchase of Whole Foods, has been trying to move into the physical space. And that's harder than a physical entity like Target moving into digital.
Because of what you need infrastructure, you need these assets, you need to create them, those sorts of things. Maybe Target has, you know, an advantage when it comes to Amazon.
Amazon's taken notice. When Target announced that it was going to offer free holiday shipping, Amazon followed suit. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a little dip was bought. Oil rebounded a bit, so be thankful for some greens, I guess. All the details when we do the numbers. It's a travel day for many of you, and good luck with that. The TSA says the 2018 Thanksgiving travel season is expected to be the busiest on record. It's actually just continuing a trend. Americans have been flying abroad a lot more lately. The National Travel and Tourism Office reports that Americans made 38 million overseas trips in 2017. That's a 9% increase from the year before. In fact, the demand for air travel is propelling some international airlines to expand into underserved cities in the U.S. Hopkins International Airport in Cleveland found itself briefly in that category, but the party didn't last. Adrian Ma from the Marketplace Hub at WCPN IdeaStream explains.
A couple of months ago, 23-year-old Natalie Kendrick did something she says was sort of uncharacteristically spontaneous.
So my friend texted me.
A one-word message that just said, Iceland? Question mark?
And I responded with, yeah, when? And then a few days later, we had tickets.
Soon, Kendrick and her friend were hiking through the Icelandic wilderness. She shows me pictures of lava rocks, green mossy fields, waterfalls, and oh, rainbows galore.
That's what it looked like everywhere you went.
This doesn't even look real.
That's what we said most of the trip. We're like,
she says another great thing about Iceland was the price to get there. Her round-trip ticket was just $300, which is not a deal she could have gotten from here a year ago. That's because for almost a decade, no transatlantic airlines were flying to Cleveland. Then suddenly this past May, two companies, Icelandair and WOW Air, landed at Hopkins International Airport.
It's a market that's kind of up for grabs.
That's Airline Weekly editor Seth Kaplan. He says what happened in Cleveland is actually part of a broader trend of global airlines opening routes in smaller markets. In recent months, carriers like British Airways and Norwegian Air have added new routes in Pittsburgh, Oakland, Providence, and Fort Lauderdale.
If you go to a smaller city, on one hand, there might be less competition. That's good from an airline's perspective. But on the other hand, there might be less demand, and that's bad.
While expanding to a new market can be risky, Kaplan says airlines have had a couple economic tailwinds that have made it easier for them to take a chance on so-called secondary cities. For one, demand for air travel is strong and growing. Also, today's planes can fly farther on less fuel than previous generations of aircraft.
And, you know, from an airline perspective, if you're right more often than you're wrong, you're doing pretty well. You're not going to bat 1,000.
Of course, getting it right can be tricky. John Grant is with the airline data firm OAG.
It's a difficult dilemma for an airline flying to those secondary markets where there probably isn't enough demand for a daily service.
Case in point.
WOW Airlines is leaving Hopkins.
Yeah, WOW. Local news outlets reported that less than 6 months after it swooped in, the budget airline called it quits in Cleveland and St. Louis and Cincinnati. Then, less than 2 days later,
Iceland Air canceled its nonstop winter flights from Cleveland to Iceland.
By the way, Iceland Air is in the process of buying WOW. Neither company responded to a request for comment, but Grant says the Cleveland market probably wasn't big enough yet to support two Iceland-based airlines that also fly to Europe. Or to put it another way, an oversupply of seats met an undersupply of butts.
It creates a very challenging environment that ultimately was unsustainable for two airline operations.
Despite the turbulence, Grant says global carriers are likely to keep experimenting in smaller cities. Even Iceland Air says it'll be back in Cleveland next summer. Not that that's much consolation for customers like John Brickle, who had planned a romantic Iceland getaway with his wife. That is, until Iceland Air canceled his November flight and tried to book him a new itinerary with two extra layovers. He said, no thanks.
Do I want to travel to Iceland in the future? Sure. But do I want to travel on one of their airlines? Very unlikely.
So for now, the only getaway he has planned this winter is to Las Vegas. In Cleveland, I'm Adrian Ma for Marketplace.
So most of us will actually not be stuck at airports over this holiday. We'll be in our car, according to AAA. We talked about oil prices yesterday on the program, and that got us looking for the cheapest and most expensive gas stations in the country. You can check that out at marketplace.org. A station in Orlando, Florida, has the highest price at almost $6 a gallon. Yeah, you heard that right. We have an unscientific survey going on right now on our Instagram account. Here's what some of you told us you've seen.
Before I left D.C., I gassed up at Costco for about $2.35 a gallon. I made a quick pit stop to see a nephew in Philadelphia where I saw a Shell at $2.69 a gallon. And then finally, when I was pulling into my hometown, Red Bank, New Jersey, I saw at the Exxon right around $2.89 a gallon.
So the gas station closest to my house is about $3.75 right now. And at Costco this morning, I paid $3.10.
That was Steve Held from Washington, D.C., and Aubrey Tonner from Yucaipa, California. We'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. We're on Instagram at MarketplaceAPM. Genetic data is becoming a big business, and those little kits are an increasingly popular holiday gift. Before you buy, though, consider where all that personal data is going. Earlier this year, gene testing company 23andMe partnered with pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline to develop personalized drugs and research treatment for diseases like lupus and Parkinson's using 23andMe's customer data. That was a surprise to some of those customers, and there are still questions about how much we should value our genetic information. Jen King is Director of Consumer Privacy at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School and has studied this issue specifically. Jen, welcome to the program.
You're welcome.
So before we dig into kind of the big privacy bugaboos, you've also done research into what motivates people to sign up for something like 23andMe, right? What's our motivation?
So I found that it's kind of a two-tier thing. On the one hand, it's, I'll put it as narcissism, and maybe a positive narcissism, in that these tests give people the ability to learn a lot about themselves that they couldn't otherwise know. And the other piece really is the ability to feel like you can do something for the public good at the same time. And so a lot of the people who do something like 23andMe will also opt into the research portion. Their data is used for research into specific diseases or potential drugs.
Narcissism and altruism, a powerful combination.
Exactly.
Well, but then is kind of the third leg of that stool the sensitivity of the information? I mean, how ultimately sensitive is the information that a company like this is collecting?
What was interesting about the study I did, most of my respondents felt that their genetic data, while it was personal, didn't reveal who they really were versus search queries. So when people type a search term into Google, for example, you know, did they consider that more personal than their genetic data? In some cases, they did, because it really revealed something more about what they were concerned about, what they thought about, what they cared about. Whereas your genetic data doesn't tell you anything about that.
But then what happens, you know, it's one thing to say, OK, I'm participating in this research project, I'm doing a social good, and I'm finding out this great stuff about me. Then you get to, you know, the news that 23andMe is partnering with a pharmaceutical company to develop drugs based on the DNA data that they got from 23andMe. Do you think that changes the calculation for people?
I think it can, because one of the things I discovered is while there's probably an assumption that, well, you know, great, I'm going to help make a drug that could, you know, help a disease I know nothing about, and maybe I'll benefit because I have that disease. At the same time, no one, at least of the people I talked to, really sat down and thought about, well, wait a second, you know, the company isn't obligated to give that drug away for free. So there was this sense of, yeah, I'm helping the public, but it wasn't very critical and really wasn't carefully thought through just exactly how that might happen. It was more of a check the box going, yay, I can do something good.
Yeah. You know, we've been having this conversation off and on about the idea that that we are increasingly becoming unpaid data laborers.
Right.
In our data-driven economy. And this seems like a really material example of that. Like, if I have a really unique DNA structure that helps contribute to a drug that could make billions of dollars for a company, I'm not getting paid.
No, and in fact, you paid them to do it, which is so unlike most of the other circumstances we look at right now with how your data is gathered and used. You actually paid them to do this one.
It feels like people are really only starting to understand the trade-offs that they're making with their data and maybe the potential value of that data. And I wonder how that's going to drive future conversations or maybe even regulation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. In the research I've done, there's definitely, I think, a growing sense that as these products and services that we contribute to become more personalized, people are beginning to realize, oh, I'm not just one little tiny data point in a giant database. That's one of the things we've seen through something like the whole Cambridge Analytica scandal with Facebook.
Jen King, thanks so much for the time.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you.
Coming up,
painting very big visions, often unrealistic visions, that one is overconfident about.
Does that sound like your company's CEO? Let's talk about it. But first, let's do the numbers. Any news is good news. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gave up less than a point, basically flat, to close at 24,464. The NASDAQ rose 63 points, 0.9%, to end at 69.72. And the S&P 500 improved 8 points, 0.3%, to finish at 26.49. Some tech companies rallied after large losses earlier this week. Facebook brightened 1.8%. Amazon was up 1.4%. Alphabet, parent company of Google, gained 1.25%. But Apple dimmed again, losing 0.1%. You heard us talk about airlines earlier, and airline stocks flew higher today, led by American Airlines, up 2%. Bond prices fell slightly. The yield on the 10-year T-note remained at 3.06%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. This week, we've been checking in with people who are living the dream at work, getting the jobs lots of people wanted when they were kids and maybe still want today. In this next chapter of our occasional series, How to Be a Blank, we're taken to the skies with two people who have a job I didn't even know I wanted until now, pilots of the famous Goodyear blimp.
My name is Taylor Dean. I'm a senior pilot with Goodyear Airship Operation.
My name is Matthew St. John. I'm the chief pilot of Wingfoot 2. Currently, we're in Carson, California. This is the Los Angeles blimp base. The airship has been stationed out here since the mid-20s.
I guess it all started when I was 13 years old and I went on a family vacation. We went down to Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, and I grew up in a small town, and as I arrived there, I realized that I loved traveling, I loved the adventure, and getting back on the plane, I realized I want to be a pilot.
After I graduated from high school, I went to an aerospace engineering school, and I got all my certifications and ratings to be a commercial pilot. And also got into sailing. I did a lot of sailing down in Florida, and it was a really good friend of mine. He's like, Matt, you're a commercial pilot, and you love sailing boats. You ever thought about airships?
Flying airplanes and flying blimps has similarities. You know, there's still airspace. You still have radios, things that are very similar. There's no airship or blimp schools out there, so everybody has a different start. You can either come from the military, you can be a helicopter pilot or an airplane pilot, and then transition over to airships. So when they hire you here, they train you in-house, and you get all of your airship time with the company.
We do a lot of sporting events in downtown Los Angeles with the Lakers and the Clippers and LA Dodgers. And so when you're down there flying around in the evening, it's a real treat to get to see the entire city lit up like a Christmas tree at night.
As far as blimps go, we're not trying to go from Los Angeles to London on a daily basis. We're just trying to make it to a sporting event, and we want to be seen along the way. We're always trying to advertise, so going slow and staying low is actually a benefit to us. It's very much like a road trip.
You could have a job where you fly from city to city, much like a kind of like a modern-day explorer, where you're only at 1,000 feet off the ground, but you're covering the United States, and it just gives you a unique perspective. There are beautiful areas where you're flying in really high terrain, like high upper elevations. You might cross a certain area where it just drops off, and next thing you know, you have a huge canyon beneath you, and you're just flying over the top of it, like the ultimate all-terrain vehicle. Those moments, it's like something out of a movie.
Taylor Dean and Matthew St. John are pilots with Goodyear based in Carson, California. We have a great video of them piloting that blimp over Los Angeles. You can see the city the way they see it from their cockpit while they float almost silently over the city. Bonus points if you can identify the sports arenas they pass over. Check it out on our YouTube channel. We're at Marketplace APM. And hey, subscribe while you're at it. As a country, we're having lots of conversations about the C-suite right now. Who's at the top, how they got there, who didn't get in, and also the attributes that can not only create bad cultures, but also be bad for business. One big one is narcissism. Jennifer Chapman is a professor of management at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. She studies narcissistic CEOs, specifically in the tech industry, where the charismatic hero founder is a big thing. But she says narcissists are not exclusive to tech. Jennifer Chapman, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
So I guess let's start with a definition. How do you actually define a narcissistic CEO?
So psychologists have defined narcissism for a long time. It's things like being overly self-interested, being more concerned about one's own outcomes than about others. But it also has to do with treating other people not well, downplaying mm-hmm. their interests, being overzealous and overconfident about one's own perspective, and painting very big visions, often unrealistic visions, that one is overconfident about.
It's funny because I hear you say this, and I feel like the scale part must be really important because that sounds like a lot of CEOs.
Well, what's interesting is that it's difficult for us to distinguish between the attributes of an effective leader and the attributes of a narcissist. Things like being confident in your position and being visionary in your orientation. Those are things we actually look for in leaders. And narcissism really is almost a continuum that says, yes, those things, but the person also has a sense of entitlement. He or she believes that the rules don't apply to them. And you often see narcissism come through in terms of discounting the contributions of other people. And those are not attributes that are associated with effective leadership.
Hmm. How does the CEO's personality, you know, how important is a CEO in setting the work culture? How much of this narcissistic personality can really trickle down to how a company operates?
Of course, CEOs have the top job. They have the formal authority to develop positions and policies. And so if any single person is going to have an impact on the culture, it's going to be the CEO who's going to have the most. And what we know specifically about narcissistic CEOs is that they develop cultures that are less focused on integrity, and those cultures are less collaborative in orientation. Even if the CEO leaves an organization, the culture is sticky, and the culture will hang around for a lot longer than any potential person will be there.
Why is that?
Well, because it's usually baked into processes and approaches to doing things. You've actually hired people to fit that culture. And so there's a big lag in terms of trying to change the culture. Even once that leader has gone, it's really baked into the organization normatively. People expect that that's the way that people are going to interact with one another. And it takes very, very deliberate action and sometimes, you know, a significant amount of time to change course.
Are narcissistic CEOs likely to hire other narcissists?
Well,
is that part of it too?
This is a really interesting question. We're doing a study right now, and what it's showing is that narcissists are significantly more likely to trade off expertise for loyalty. They are much more likely to hire and surround themselves with people who are loyal to them, regardless of their level of expertise. So ultimately, what that means is that narcissists are going to be exposed to less relevant information, less expertise in making important decisions within an organization. And so you can imagine how quickly that's going to become very problematic.
Jennifer Chapman, professor of management at UC Berkeley Business School, thank you so much for the time.
You're welcome.
This final note before we go, there are a few hours left on the newest unofficial shopping day of the holiday season. According to CNBC, retailers are now pushing Green Wednesday. Oh, did you think I meant environmental stuff? No, I meant weed. Apparently, many of you already knew that Green Wednesday was a thing because cannabis retailers and analysts, yes, we have cannabis analysts now, say marijuana delivery and sales of edibles, accessories, and gifts like cannabis-infused chocolate spiked last year on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. Sales were second only to April 20th, you know, 420 day. All right, I gotta go. Basically flat on Wall Street today. The Dow gave up less than a point, the NASDAQ up 63 points, and the S&P 500 improved 8 points. Sarah Bruguere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered this program for us, and very well at that. I'm Molly Wood. Have a great holiday, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.